Hot 93.7.
It's at 93.7. Hartford's number one for hip hop and R&B. My name is Jenny Boom Boom, and DJ Michi's here too.
Hello, how are you doing?
And this is the Beat of CT. And today we have Michael Williams, who's the Deputy Commissioner of Operations for the Connecticut Department of Children and Families Foster Care Division. Wow, that title is big. How you doing there, Mr. Williams? Everything good?
I'm doing fine. Doing fine. Complain about yourself.
I was just telling Mr. Williams that his voice is just unbelievably great for radio, and you should be actually on the radio with us every day.
Hey, maybe I should think about a career change.
Maybe you should. So what's happening these days over there at the Connecticut Department of Children and Families?
Yeah, just as all other state agencies and operations that exist, we're weathering this pandemic storm.
Yeah.
Trying to assure that we fulfill our primary mission, which is to keep children safe and to strengthen families. And doing that simultaneously, making sure our workforce is safe. And so that's been a major challenge for us through this, but we're doing well.
I was wondering about that because, I mean, are you guys like visiting families? Is that still going on or?
So we had to institute several measures as this pandemic started to get worse, you know, in mid to early March, we started seeing the numbers kind of grow and escalate in Connecticut. You know, close to the New York border, as New York was really growing large numbers of folks infected. We saw that happening here. And we had to decide, make some critical decisions for the safety of our workforce. Mm. We knew that if we wanted to contribute to the public safety and try to control the spread of this virus, as been talked about by our governor and by governors in the neighboring states, we really have to implement some strict stay-home orders. And so for our workforce, roughly about 84-85% of the folks who work for DCF was told to stay home and work from home through teleworking processes. The challenge that brought to us, obviously, is that once we get a call for abuse and neglect to us made, a report made by, you know, a mandated reporter or whatever, we have to make the decision of whether or not we're going to go out and do a face-to-face, in-person interview and intervention with a family and children to address the contents of that report. What we decided that we would do for the sake of our workforce safety and for the sake of the safety of kids is to implement a process where we would look at the circumstances a little bit carefully than we normally would prior to going out, and then make a decision as to whether or not an in-person face-to-face visit was really, really necessary. And only in those situations where we get reports that tell us that a child is in danger and is being abused, physically abused, we would go in person. What people don't really know about DCF is that, you know, contrary to the perception, 90% of the cases and families we get involved with have not due to physical abuse, it's due to neglect. Issues related to neglect. And there are a lot of families who, in the absence of just basic needs, could address their issues that brought them to our attention if they had the support and help from the department. And so we decided to address those families remotely and to do virtual work with them to get the services and supports they needed so that whatever the concern was that came brought them to our attention can be addressed that way.
Me and Michi have talked about this, you know, in detail in the past because, you know, we both have friends that work, you know, for DCF. Yeah. And there are just, you know, not going into too much detail, but there are things that we have heard about some of the things that you guys have seen and have experienced. You guys are doing such great work, but man, you hear some really terrible things.
And unfortunately, we are living in a society where those things do happen to children, things that you wouldn't guess, which is scratch your head and say, how could someone do that to an innocent child? Do happen. That's the bad news. But for us, if there's a good news or silver lining, that's not the majority of the story of what's struggling with that bring them to our attention. Obviously, those stories get the headlines.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Parent harms a child or a caregiver does something to a child that brings harm or death or physical injury or sexual abuse horrifically to children. Those get headlines, but those aren't the majority of the cases. That's a small percentage, less than 10% of cases would fit in that category. And those are heartbreaking. They are heart-wrenching to have to get involved when most of the time there were situations where those could have been avoided. if people in communities and family members who knew these individuals sort of spoke up earlier, gave a heads up, and made reports to us and trusted us enough that if we got involved, we would do it in the best interest of the child and the parent that's there. Some of that could have been avoided. A lot of times people know, but they just don't say anything. It's mind my own business kind of culture that exists on a small percentage of those cases like that.
Yeah. Do you think that as years went on, and how long have you been with DCF?
About 16 years now.
16. So as time has gone on and people, you know, disassociating themselves with each other because of the internet and everything else, do you feel that folks are less likely to get involved now with families than maybe 16 years ago?
No, right now we see an increase of folks getting involved.
Oh, that's great.
Yes. You know, and that's because we really, really are working hard to change our image. I mean, there was a reason why people didn't get involved with us, because as an agency doing the work that we do, sometimes we don't do it that well. And sometimes in the past, we made mistakes and removed children who should have stayed home and kept children at home who should have been removed. And, you know, we didn't really trust family members and kinship and relatives to place kids with them whenever children can't stay with their bio parents safely. We, you know, had an aversion towards placing kids or letting kids stay with relatives. And so kids went into stranger foster care, and growing up in those kinds of scenarios is extremely traumatic to children, to not be able to really see their parents or stay connected to their family network and separate them by putting them into stranger foster care. Didn't do kids that well. And so, you know, when people start seeing those kind of outcomes we were producing, they didn't trust us, and we don't blame them. And so we really had to take stock in the way in which we did our work and change our practice and really begin to do things differently, primarily to become more of a strengthening family approach to our work than just a safety alone. I mean, we have the reputation, and people still call refer to us as taking your children. And we want to change that kind of language, because we don't take children. We remove children from unsafe situations. But in the past, we were labeled with that kind of label of DCF as baby snatchers, or they take your children. And now what we're saying is that the first thing we want to do if we're getting involved in a family is make sure we assess that family well enough to determine whether or not what that family need is an intervention that can strengthen them and have children stay home safely. Once we start shifting our practice in that regard, it meant that our social work staff, our supervisors and managers all had to take a second look at those situations that came to our attention and ask the question, what is it these families really, really need? You know, is it foster care for kids to come out of a home, or is it something else that we can offer, some in-home services or some concrete basic service needs? Maybe 3 months of rental assistance can help them get through an economic crisis that will stabilize the family. So anything that would bring about strengthening to the family is the direction we started taking. Then secondly, we had to really have the families and communities trust us to say, if we can't keep a child home safely with their biological parents safely, then our first placement that we will make of them, the place we put children, is with families of people they know, either kin or relatives or, you know, coaches, pastors, people who these children have some kind of familiarity with, rather than strangers' homes. And so that really started to change our relationship with community, because what it basically said is that even though you're not parenting your child, where your child is living, you can still have a relationship with them because it's somebody you know too. You know, mom, dad, it's your parents, it's, you know, the grandparents, it's an aunt, it's an uncle, it's cousins, it's kin. You can feel confident if you have a substance abuse, you know, heroin addiction, or any kind of thing that you're really, really struggling with that caused you not to be able to parent your children safely, you can now go take care of that, knowing your children are with people who are going to take care of them because they know them.
You know, as far as little kids that can't speak for themselves, how do you decide whether or not they can be safe staying in the home.
Yeah, and that is the most vulnerable population that we have to work with. And usually what brings little kids to our attention are situations where they end up in an emergency department with a broken bone or some other kind of physical injury that has occurred to them, and no one can describe how it happened. And so our investigators are trained enough to know and ask those questions to determine whether or not this is an accidental injury, or is it questionable enough to think that someone has physically harmed this little one? And if there are no supports or no safety plans that can be put in place, like if there's relatives who are staying with the mom and the child, or the dad and the child, or the parent and the child, who can also keep an eye on that family, or if there's no early child care center that the child's going to that would watch them every day. If the parent and that child are isolated at home by themselves, that's a huge risk factor as well, which our major concern is right now through this pandemic of stay home is a lot of parents are home with children by themselves, and those children are not visible to anyone else.
Right. So it's for someone else to step in and say, maybe something's wrong.
Yeah.
Sorry. And I just wanted to tell you too, because you know, Meechie's not a parent yet, but when you bring your kids to the emergency room, Meech, and something goes wrong, say you go over to CCMC, bring the kids in, like my daughter broke her arm one time, they will literally ask you 100 times what happened.
Right.
And they will come in multiple times, different people will come in and say, so what happened again? I love the fact that they do that to see whether or not, you know, you're telling the truth and you're not physically harming your child. And I just love the fact that they do that because, you know, who knows, right?
Right.
Absolutely. And that's the heartbreaking part of the work we do. And that is that as much as we want to trust folks to tell us the truth, but when it doesn't match up with the science and with the evidence and the exams and the forensic exams that doctors and nurses would give a child and say, they're saying the kid fell out of a chair and the kid has a cracked skull, that don't match.
You know? Right.
Now, Michael, I know that it's National Foster Care Appreciation Month throughout this month of May. I know that there's a lot of events that usually occur, but now that we're like inside and can't really be out like that, what is the department doing to recognize like some of these families?
That's one of the tragedies of this pandemic of events that had to get canceled. That during this month, we would have celebrations occurring all over the state, celebrating the phenomenal work that licensed caregivers give, which we're trying to change the name from foster parents to caregivers too, because that's exactly what they do. They give care to children,
right,
not their own. And we would really try to show our appreciation for the phenomenal work that they do, because it takes a particular person to do this work of foster parenting and caregiving. And we see some heroes and phenomenal people come forth and open their homes and their hearts up to kids from 0 to 18, and kids who come with a whole lot of trauma, you know, some histories that, you know, you and I probably never have in our entire lifetime. And they parent them and they give them love and they give them care and they nurture these children. And these children are resilient and they start bouncing back and do that. And so the work that foster parents do, you know, we feel have to get celebrated in our society. And so this month gave us the opportunity to do it. Now we can't. So we are trying to find different ways of telling them thank you, from, you know, Zoom events to looking at restaurants to offer special meals, you know, because usually it's a banquet style event that occurs with recognitions. And so, you know, giving them individual kinds of things to go have a meal on the department, or even raise the daily rate that they get as a stipend for children in their care. So they have a little bit more, because now kids are home all day. They don't have school to where school they can get breakfast and lunch. Now that's on the caregiver as well.
Yeah. And I just want to tell you that all the events that I volunteer for with DCF, I just absolutely love them. I think you guys are just a class act.
Thank you. Thank you. I love hearing that, because I'm biased. I believe we have the best workforce in the state of Connecticut.
So say someone like me would love to become a foster parent. Say someone would love to be a foster parent. What is the criteria? How do you become a foster parent, Michael?
There are two, well, actually three types of foster parents that that we have. The first is a relative caregiver. And the way one becomes that is if a member of your family, unbeknownst to you, has had us involved and the child that they have is not safe, you may get a knock on the door from us and from your cousin or relative saying, hey, DCF is here and they want to remove my child. And they asked me to bring people to the table who could be possible caregivers. And if you raise your hand and say, I would, after a background check and a walkthrough, making sure there are no safety issues or you don't have any issues or with criminal or abuse and neglect, then that child will start living with you. Then you'll start going through a licensing process and a training process. And those are the ones who, you talk about true heroes. I mean, they step up at the knock of a door. They don't go through the training to prepare them. So that's our kinship and relative caregivers. The second kind are what we call our core foster homes. And those are people who are sitting home and saying, you know, I want to do this thing. Like your question you just asked, you know, I want to be a foster parent. What would I think I want to give back to children. I heard about this and I want to do it. And so they would call us and express an interest of becoming a foster parent. And with that information that you give us, our foster care team would reach out to you and engage you in a series of conversations around your interest and around your background and your history and experience. And from that conversation, assuming nothing rules you out, which, you know, those the rule outs are things like you have a long history with DCF with abuse and neglect. You know, we won't go that way. Or you have criminal records that are related to physically harming kids and things like that. So assuming nothing rules you out, then you will come in and then you will go through a series of trainings through a curriculum, an evidence-based curriculum that we have that prepares foster parents. And we send you through that. You get that set of training, and then from that a study of your home and all occurs, and then you get a license. And then the third type is the same similar kind of training occurs, but it's for a higher level of care, which we call our therapeutic foster care system. Those are people who go through that initial basic training through the evidence-based curriculum, but they also work with a mental health agency to get a lot of mental health training to equip them to provide therapeutic care for kids in their home. So children who they get will be children with higher level of therapeutic need. And their interventions will be designed based on the clinical presentations of a child. And their supports that they get will be from the mental health agency, who will be the licensor of the holder of their license.
So can people be, I'm just curious about how the system works, because if you're a foster parent, are some people just foster parents forever until the kids actually become adults, or do most families actually adopt these children?
Yeah, it's about 50-50. I mean, there are people who do this and that's all they do, and they work with the biological parents in a partnership to say, okay, I will take care of your child while you get your needs met, but the goal is to reunify your child with you, and that biological parent and that foster parent can build a relationship. We're calling it the Quality Parenting Initiative, the QPI. That's our new approach to this, because we know when the foster parent and the bio parent have a partnership in this, bio parents do extremely well in whatever rehabilitation work they have to do. Kids go home sooner, and that relationship sticks. They become, you know, long-term relationships and supports to bio parents. And so we really try to promote that. And there are foster parents who only want to do that kind of work. Then there are foster parents who come in for that kind of work, but any natural situation, you get a little one in your home, that little one stay 1, 2, 3 years, you fall in love and it's like, I can't let go. And if nobody else comes forth to adopt that little one, then they end up adopting those children. So we have a lot of foster parents who end up doing that as well. They end up adopting. Then we have the very tough ones, when you get foster parents who's fallen in love with a child and want to adopt, and the child's been with them for 2 years, 3 years, and the bio parents who get their act together, or a relative comes forth and it's like, I want my child with me, or I want my cousin or my grandkids living with us. And now you got the struggle over who's the right choice.
Yeah, I feel like I couldn't give the baby back. Sorry. I have big issues with that. Big issues. I fall in love, Michael. I fall in love hard, you know?
No, well, that just means you're normal. It's like everyone else. I mean, we get that a lot. It's tough when those situations happen. And I'm sure if you interview a whole lot of foster parents, they'll tell you that the most difficult part of their job is to let kids go.
So with COVID-19 happening right now, and you said, you touched upon this earlier, families are in their homes and basically have to deal with each other, which can be really, really hard. You know, if someone suspects something might be going on, or if a family member in the house doesn't feel safe, what should they do? What is the step that they should take?
So if there's a belief that a child is being harmed, currently being harmed in a home, please call the DCF hotline, Caroline. If a parent is in a situation to where they feel as though they're not, we say they're losing it, right? Mm-hmm. They can't take it anymore. Things are happening that cause them to act in ways that they normally wouldn't. We've created a warm line that we call the Talk It Out line.
Can you access that from 211?
You can, yeah.
Okay, all right, yeah.
And it, even though we kind of created it, it's not a DCF hotline. It's not our hotline. It's a line for families who just need somebody to talk to.
Right, yeah.
Make the difference, you know, just to have a conversation with a counselor or someone about what you're feeling, what you're thinking, and they can talk you through it, and it could prevent abuse or neglect happening right at that moment, which is the ultimate goal.
Okay. Because people can get frustrated with their children. I mean, it happens all the time. So
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so those are the arenas that people have to report or to call in to get help. We have emergency mobile services that can still active and operational that can come out and do that kind of intervention as well, a mental health intervention if needed, and families are feeling like they're losing it. The most important message is through these times, whenever there's a suspicion that a child is being harmed, don't hold back on that. We really want people to act and be proactive on that so we can keep children safe. We have seen some cases that have come in that are not good. Again, these are cases that if someone would have acted,
things might have been different.
Things would have been a lot different. Not necessarily cases known to us, but cases that I'm sure was known to other people.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Michael Williams. We really appreciate it. He's the Deputy Commissioner of Operations for the Connecticut Department of Children and Families Foster Care Division. Appreciate all the great info today.
Well, thank you all. I appreciate you taking time with us to hear more about what we're doing at DCF.
Of course. Absolutely. Of course. You guys are doing such great, important work. And I'm telling you, contact me if you got anything going on. You know, I love the kids.
I will definitely do that.
All right. Thank you. It's at 937.
Connecticut Against Violence presents the 7th Annual Virtual Youth Summit for Bridgeport Public High School students, June 12, 1 p.m. to